We're talking with Joseph Farrell, whose new book, Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, discusses the rise of breakaway civilizations. And I use that as in the plural sense because he makes the case that there might be more than one. We'll get into that and name a couple of names when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph Farrell, of course, you're an academic guy, an historian. You didn't start out as a UFO guy, I'm presuming, but at some point you had to address this stuff. And I guess there's a parallel there for American leaders, world leaders at the end of World War II, when the first great UFO flaps occurred. You know, that for those who are in our audience who still don't believe in UFO reality or whatever, it's probably there's no amount of proof that would ever convince them. But at some point, you've read enough stuff to convince you. And at some point, people like Harry Truman saw enough that they convinced them, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, I think in President Truman's case, if he didn't need any convincing after 1947 with, you know, Kenneth Arnold and Roswell and so on and so forth, he was certainly convinced by 1952 with the Washington, D.C. UFO flap. So I just don't see how you can treat of the whole idea of the founding of the national security state without addressing the subject of UFOs, because I think Mr. Dolan's research has made it clear that if there's anything that's central to the founding of the national security state, that's at least one of the principal keys.
What has the recent spate of attention since Edward Snowden's revelations about the NSA and this massive spying operation, what has that done to your general thesis? I guess confirmed a lot of it, but I have to imagine nobody envisioned it going quite this far, did they?
No, I don't think so. And I think we're looking at quite a deal of blowback. You know, we have Brazil and France and Germany indicating they want to create U.S.-free internets, and Brazil also dropped a contract with Boeing for some fighter jets and went with the Saab company in Sweden for similar national security concerns, and you can't really blame them. So I think, yeah, we're living with some significant blowback, and I really can't see it's going to decrease anytime soon.
Describe for me breakaway civilizations, plural, because you make the point that mm-hmm. there's probably more than one. Describe which ones you think exist and what they're up to.
Well, I definitely think you have an American component, and certainly I don't think anyone would deny that. But I think you have indicators of significant corporate involvement in this that's very private and almost completely independent in some cases of national security concerns. And, you know, I'm thinking particularly of IG Farben in Nazi Germany and the fact that it took so long to dismember after the war. But I'm also thinking in terms of what I uncovered researching this book. And let me get into one of the names here that you wanted to talk
sure.
about. Most people are probably familiar with the name of Richard Bissell, who was another one of these covert operations gurus in the CIA during the 1950s and early 1960s. It was Bissell that was in charge not only of U-2 flights, but of the development of the U-2 aircraft.
He was instrumental in choosing the location for Area 51, by the way.
Oh, yes. And in addition to all of this, he's running covert operations like the Italian elections in 1948 that the United States helped with some of this hidden slush money to defeat the communists in that election. So in other words, we're dealing with a real covert operations guru. And one of the interesting things about my research that I uncovered was that Bissell was also instrumental in the development of the spy satellite, their very early spy satellites. And he did this by tapping into what Alan Dulles himself called, quote, unvouchered funds, unquote. And I took that to mean precisely this hidden slush fund of capital that they had access to that was wholly independent of even the black budget. That was this hidden system of finance that Truman put into place. And while I'm researching that, I discovered that they were developing the cameras and the optics systems for these spy satellites, And the Rockefeller family stepped in with private money to develop the backup systems for these optical systems. So in other words, what we have is evidence of a private interest by virtue of it funding out of its own pocket the development of these sophisticated technologies and secret technologies. In effect, what it's doing is it's buying influence and access. So I think we have to look at the private aspects of all of this, the corporate aspects of all of this, and Mr. Dolan and his co-author, Bryce Zabel, in their recent book, AD, After Disclosure, they also talk about the possibility that corporations have now basically taken over and are running the show, and that's the best way to keep these things secret. I think you're looking at European versions of this hidden breakaway technological civilization. I think certainly there's a lot of evidence that you find a similar thing that went on in the Soviet Union, probably still is going on in that country. China, basically any great power that has some technological sophistication, I think is going to have some version of this.
And you think a version of Nazis from Germany still exists in some incarnation?
Yes, I do. And the reason why I think that we have to entertain that possibility is we go back to some of the things I've written in some other books like Nazi International and so on, SS, Brotherhood of the Bell, that there's every indication that after the war, the Nazis continue some of their most advanced research projects independently. And the reason that I think that this was of major concern to the American national security establishment is if you look closely at the development of UFO-related documents, particularly during and after the Roswell incident, you find something very interesting. There is, of course, the Shulgin Intelligence Collection Memorandum, which exists, incidentally, I hope everybody realizes, in a genuine and in a faked version. Now, The intelligence collection memorandum was most likely drawn up by a fellow by the name of Alfred Leyding. He was a German-American engineer born to German parents in this country. And he worked at Wright-Patterson Air Base. In other words, he had access to General Twining. He had access to the paperclip Nazi scientists like Walter Lippisch and some other people that had been brought to Wright-Patterson. So he was in contact with these people. And in the Shulgin Collection Memorandum, what he suggests that the Air Force do, and of course Shulgin signs off on this, is to find where particular German scientists are. They don't know, and they want to know. So in other words, the Air Force is immediately thinking that they're dealing with something independent and they're dealing with something Nazi. But a year later, Leyding, creates what many people believe to be a genuine document, I'm certainly in that camp, called the White Hot Intelligence Estimate. And in that memo, he entertains an extraterrestrial hypothesis for UFOs. So in other words, he's in the both-and camp. He thinks there's a hidden human terrestrial development of some of this technology, and he thinks there's an extraterrestrial component. And the reason that he gives for that assumption is very, very interesting. He thinks that there is simply, and I wholeheartedly buy this line of thinking, he thinks there's simply too many UFOs doing things that even the Nazis wouldn't dream of accomplishing with their technology. But there's simply too many out there to be accounted for by any sort of secret project because the numbers exceed human production capacity. And this becomes another argument, in my opinion, for why they would have thought that they would need vast amounts of capital. They need vast amounts of capital, not only to develop the technology, which is probably very expensive, but also the production facility to create enough of it, at least, to create the idea that we've achieved some sort of parity with the phenomenon. And this is the man, I think, that we have to look at very carefully because he's formulating a kind of both-and analysis of the UFO problem. Now, that's significant because it to my mind, indicates the type of thinking that begins to occur in the national security establishment. And it's that, in turn, I think, that may have led them to strike even deeper deals with some of these Nazi scientists. You know, okay, give us more of your technology, and we'll cut you in on this deal and that deal, perhaps make information available to you, expand your financial resources, and so on and so forth. So we're literally making deals with the devil to deal with a long-term phenomenon represented by the UFO. So definitely, I think that group continues to exist in some fashion.
You make the point in the book about anti-gravity research. There was a lot of interesting stuff going on. You don't mention it in your book, but I remember working on this and speaking to John Lear about his father. There's some references mm-hmm. to Bill Lear being on the edge of some breakthroughs in yes. anti-gravity technology. He even bragged about it. And then all of a sudden, as you note in your book, it vanished. The whole yeah. thing went away.
Yeah, it just goes completely dark. That occurs around 1954, 1955. And that's a very significant year because it's in that time frame, like I suggested before, that the U.S. Air Force is secretly interviewing Dr. Ronald Richter. It's in that time frame that we see Thomas Townsend Brown, who, of course, was advocating electrogravitic types of technologies. He begins to go underground and then to behave in ways that intentionally, I think, draw a bit of ridicule to his work in order to deflect opinion away from him. It's during that precise time, incidentally, that we see in the Soviet Union the work of people like Nikolai Kozarev, the famous astronomer, also begin to go dark and go black. So it's a virtual blackout, as you say, and it happens right at this time. And I think the reason why, George, is that they must have, at that point in history, begun to see good results for the money that they had begun to lavish on some of these technologies. There, to my mind, would be no other reason why you would all of a sudden clamp down such a cone of secrecy and silence on it.
In the early 90s, I was able to go to Russia twice and mm-hmm. Meet with Ministry of Defense folks, government officials who had never been interviewed before about the right. UFO issue. And this one colonel who had been head of the world's largest UFO study, 10-year-long study ordered by the Ministry of Defense. Every unit in the vast Soviet military empire was supposed to report and investigate any kind of UFO incident, and it all went to his desk. And he said the purpose of it was we wanted to compete with Americans in terms of stealth technology. We knew that these UFOs could do things that we could not do. We wanted to figure out how to do it ourselves. And it sort of confirms what you're saying these other breakaway civilizations were doing.
Well, yeah, I think you've got a model here that began to be put into place, and certainly in the Soviet Union we saw the same thing. Back in Nazi Germany, I've written somewhat a great deal about an entity in the SS called the Kammerstab, which was directly under the control of an SS general by the name of Hans Kammler, who had a doctorate in engineering. He was the man that was in charge of all of their secret weapons research and development. But this particular group was kind of a, for want of a better expression, it was kind of a Nazi think tank that had been tasked to develop and brainstorm second, third, and even fourth generation weapons systems and the technology trees of how they would get there. So in other words, you're kind of looking at a Nazi version of DARPA, okay? I think that this sort of entity became the model for all of these post-war black projects research, and I think that's exactly what you have with and find with people like Bissell and Leyding, because they have their fingers in so many different pies. And it becomes clear, especially in Bissell's case, that he's coordinating something that's just outside of the frame of vision. He's, you know, coordinating covert ops and covert activities and satellite projects and secret technologies. So he's got his finger in an awful lot of pies.
One of the other names that that you get into, not only in this most recent book, but in your earlier works, is Ben Rich. You
Oh,
mentioned
yes.
Ted Bissell, and I told you that Bissell had been involved in creating Area 51. Well, the
Right.
guy who sort of brought everything at Area 51 to true fruition was Ben Rich, and there have been some mentions about his statements before, but you brought them all together, I think, in the second volume of this book. The outrageous, seemingly outrageous things that he said in public that all but spelled it out.
Yeah, Ben Rich was, if people don't know who he was the former chief of Lockheed Martin's Skunk Works. And he took over from another famous engineer by the name of Clarence Kelly. And incidentally, in my books, I point out that Thomas Townsend Brown, the name that most people associate with American development of gravitational type of propulsion systems, also at this period of history in the 50s and so on, had a close connection, working relationship with Lockheed, and therefore he probably would have known Clarence Kelly and Ben Rich. But
or Kelly Johnson, you mean?
Oh, pardon me. Yeah, Kelly
yeah.
Johnson. Pardon me. I'm
yeah.
sorry. But Ben Rich made some statements at the end of his life after he had retired that when you stop and think of them, they are really kind of breathless. And they're so extreme that I don't think that they come out of any sort of psychological operation designed to convince other people that we have technologies that we may not have. He would say things like, "We found an error in the equations, and now we have the capability of taking ET home, and we have things in the desert, you know, that George Lucas would die for," and so on and so forth. All sorts of strange statements like this. But the thing that intrigues me here, George, is the allusion to finding an error in equations. He never says or indicates whose equations or what equations he's talking about. But clearly what he's suggesting is that there has been under development for quite some time a paradigm of physics that is unknown to the public. And if you have a different paradigm of physics, then you have a different technology. Now, if someone were to come along and say something like that out of the clear blue, I'd tend to dismiss them. But when someone in his position says it, I sit up and take notice, and I start looking for possible corroboration. Well, the corroboration comes in the form of a NASA scientist currently at NASA by the name of Dr. Harold White, Sonny White, who has, if you research the name, you can go online, you can even find his papers, who has recast the warp drive equations of Mexican physicist Miguel Alcibiar. And that particular physicist published, I think it was in the American Journal of Physics or something, some scientific academic journal back in the 1990s, equations for warp drive. But the problem was the amount of energy that would be required would be the equivalent of the mass energy conversion of the entire planet Jupiter, which, of course, is way beyond human achievement. But Sonny White came along and said, no, if we reconfigure the geometry of what we're dealing with this way, in a particular way, then the actual energy requirement falls rather dramatically. And he's working on experiments, proof of concept experiments, as we speak for NASA. And the other interesting thing that kind of corroborates what Ben Rich said is I ran into statements from DARPA once again that they came right out and said that we want the United States to be warp capable. And I hope everybody understands what this means. You know, we're talking Gene Roddenberry, we're talking Star Trek, we're talking Babylon 5 and all of the science fiction shows. DARPA came out and said that they want the United States to be warp capable in 100 years.
Joseph, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, I want to ask you a little bit more about the secret space program. Describe what you think we have up there in terms of hardware. We're talking with Joseph Farrell, whose new book, Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, gives us a lot to chew on. When we come back, we get into what these secret space programs might look like and what they're up to. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph Farrell, before I forget about it, you have an event coming up, a public appearance in, I guess, in June. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
That's toward the end of June, the last weekend of June. I'll be speaking at a secret space program conference with Richard Dolan and Secretary Fitz, I believe Dr. Carol Rosen. I'm not certain that she's been confirmed yet. Robert Morningstar, I believe, will be there. That'll be the last weekend of June.
It's not a secret conference. It's about the secret. It's a conference about the secret space program, right?
Right. Sorry.
All right. We tried to put a link on our Coast to Coast site, but it's not working right now. If we can get that operating, we'll put it up there so you can look around for more information. But it's in San Mateo, California, June 28th, 29th. Before the break, we were talking about Ben Rich and some of the statements he has made, the former head of Skunk Works. If anyone should know about a secret space program, it would be him. He all
Right.
but came out, and one of the comments that he made that you mentioned in I think your second book in this series, is the statement he made about this technology could take us to the stars, but we'll never release it. It'll
Right.
never be released. It's in black programs, and you couldn't get it out there with dynamite or something like that, right?
Yes, that's right. I think it's something to the effect that God himself couldn't do it. And I think the reason why people ask me about this all the time, about why hasn't this technology been released, I think to a certain extent we're seeing some of it being released now. The current craze and push of 3D printing and manufacturing techniques, this is a technology that's been around for some time, but they're pushing it very heavily right now. And I suspect that it's one of those technologies that may have been developed in the black world for manufacture of some pretty sophisticated technology. But there's another reason, George, I think that this technology continues to be suppressed publicly, and that is that, and I've said this many times, that if you're dealing with a technology that at any point is capable of, so to speak, engineering the fabric of space-time on the laboratory bench, or if you have a workable, working, even prototypical zero-point energy technology, then if you let that get out and fall into the wrong hands and it be weaponized, then you really have a potential for a technology that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. And I think as far as these elites are concerned, they haven't really solved the problem of how to prevent that kind of weaponization and proliferation. I think that's a large part of why things have been prevented from getting out.
Or they just want to keep it for themselves for whatever
and
reason.
that too.
I wonder if you look at the saber rattling going on with the U.S. and Russia right now about the Ukraine and whether or not the Russians know we have what we have. And we know they've got something, but maybe it's not the same as what we have. And if you were to weaponize it, I would imagine it could be do terrible, terrible things.
Yes, oh, absolutely, absolutely. Like I said, if you weaponize this stuff, you really have something that does have the potential to make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. And ultimately, I think this is what was driving the Nazis in their own research in this whole field is, Nazis being Nazis, they want to make a weapon out of it. But Ben Rich, I think he was probably letting us in on a huge secret that there is some sort of hidden space technology, and that, like you say, they're keeping it to themselves for the moment for whatever reason.
Gary McKinnon, this hacker in Britain who got into
Yes.
some NASA computers some years ago, and he came across what he saw was evidence of a secret space program, astronauts' names, names of ships.
Yes.
Do you have an idea about the scope of our secret space program, how big it might be, and what they're doing up there?
Oh boy, that's an excellent question. And it takes me back again to this hidden system of finance and what I think they may have done and how they sold it to the prime bankers to participate in essentially a system that ultimately was based on a kind of fraud. I think, George, that what we're looking at here is essentially a Venetian system. Because if you look back at Venice and how it conducted its trade, the bankers on the Rialto would loan money to merchants trading with the Orient. And as a kind of a collateral. They demanded a percentage of the take. And I think in terms of this hidden system of finance, that model was put into play from a very, very early period. And effectively what they did was they collateralized space and whatever resources were found out there. I think this in part is partly the explanation behind why we have quadrillions of dollars worth of derivatives sloshing around in the system. I think space was collateralized. So as to what they may have out there, I strongly suspect that they do have some sort of prototypical Mark I stage of field propulsion systems that they are able to get out there rather easily. And the reason I'm thinking this again, George, is the signals that we're getting from the public aspect of this is they are pushing asteroid mining and moon bases and moon resources and even, you know, mining Mars and establishing colonies there. They're pushing these things in a very sort of deliberate, quiet way. And I think that this is so that they can prepare us for the idea that space will be privatized and collateralized. And that in turn implies something else very significant, and I hope people realize what it is. And that is that ultimately where you put strong commercial interests, you're going to put a military interest. So in other words, look for talk, increasing talk of the weaponization of space. And we're seeing that too.
I wonder if the Chinese are hip to the jive, so to speak. I mean, the Chinese have their own space program. They're going to the moon. You know, we haven't had time to even get into it, but you make a point in this book that, look, there's evidence of life elsewhere, that on the moon, on Mars, that NASA has basically obfuscated every chance it gets. There's a whole series of strange events around probes that were sent to Mars. And I just wonder if the Chinese get to the moon before we get back there, set up a base, whether they would go along with the game or whether they'd spill some beans.
That's the $64 trillion question. My inclination, George, is that they probably would go along with the game. And the reason why is it doesn't really help them to expose it too much so long as they could get their own hands into the commercial opportunities that are present, into the military opportunities that are certainly present in outer space. I don't think that they would play the game of upsetting the apple cart until after they had established some sort of space parity or space supremacy over their competitors. Then they might be inclined, but I don't think they're going to do that as long as their program is in these nascent stages.
Would we risk flying these? Let's say we've got flying saucers, American-made flying saucers under the control of this breakaway civilization. You think that explains a lot of what we see as UFO sightings. But I wonder, how often we risk flying them around because something could go wrong, it crashes, the public gets to see it, or are they so confident that they could cover it up that it's not a worry? And I ask it with this caveat. You note in the book that at some point the U.S. government said, stop shooting at UFOs. And I know the Russians have done the same thing, too. You make the point that we stop shooting at them because some of them are ours.
Well, some of them may be ours, but I think the other problem that, and you're raising a very good point, I think the other problem that this breakaway group has is they cannot make too many overt and open demonstrations of whatever technological capabilities they have. I think they have made some, but not very many. And precisely for what you say, there's a risk element involved that some of this stuff may get out, that there may be an accident of some sort and it be discovered. I certainly think that that's part of their thinking and would prevent them from doing too much in near-Earth space. That's the key right there. If they have this capability, my guess is that they have used it, as I've said, for certain commercial purposes, probably for some covert exploration and perhaps even excavation on other planets. Who knows? I don't think the other reason that we have to look at that argument is going back to Alfred Leyding. I don't think that we can safely say at all that all UFO reports are related to secret terrestrial projects. There are simply far too many, I think, that the production capacity I just don't see as being there on humanity's part to account for all of these different sightings and some of the things we see them doing.
And then we have the big unanswered questions about the others, the visitors, the aliens, whatever you want to call them, wherever they're right. from, what they're up to. I mean, because they're here we are developing this technology, these breakaway civilizations, presumably to defend ourselves or compete with whoever these guys are to yes. emulate the technology they have, assuming that they're still standing still, you know, that's
yeah,
their technology.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the other part of the problem. The as far as I can tell, George, in researching these three books, the concern in trying to reverse engineer the decision-making culture of this national security group, when you have UFOs frequenting our thermonuclear tests, frequenting our nuclear weapons sites and facilities, our missile bases, Soviet missile bases, and actually in some cases turning them off, taking them completely offline, and in other cases reprogramming the targeting information in the missiles, or in the case of a famous incident inside of the Soviet Union, in the Ukraine incidentally, a UFO actually initiated the launch sequence independently of Moscow or anybody else. So
yeah, I know. That's one of the cases that I'm the guy that brought that back from the Ukraine.
Those documents. You are?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know about that one then. So, you know, looking at cases like that, the national security establishment is going to think that, first of all, for whatever reason, these things are interested in nuclear weapons. They are performing actions that can be interpreted as hostile, but not overtly, drastically threatening. So, you know, I'm making a bit of a fine distinction between the two. And in that case, what they're going to do is they're going to try to develop technologies to emulate these things. They're going to try to figure out why they're so interested in nuclear weapons and nuclear physics, and that's a whole other part of the story, you know, that we didn't even get into, that I think is a major, major part of the story. But again, they're going to make demonstrations, but I think, as you say, at the risk of doing too many and having this technology escape, I think they're going to limit their activity very, very severely.
You suspect that they have weather control capabilities as part of this technology?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I
think
do.
You touch on that in the book. I can't remember how advanced you think we might be in that.
Well, I think it's probably fairly advanced. It's interesting to recall that at least as far as America is concerned, research into the ability to manipulate weather systems for gaining battlefield advantages or even for the purposes of destruction, this began in the 50s. It received a huge impetus in the early 1960s. And I think, again, that the UFO may be a hidden part of this story, because if you have the ability to manipulate the weather, you can turn the planet into something pretty miserable for anyone to try and invade or occupy or land on and so forth. So it's another way of demonstrating that you have the ability to manipulate systems on a planetary scale, and that's going to send a very powerful message to whoever it is they think may be out there.
I sure wish whoever controls this technology would help us out here in the West. We're having a heck of a drought.
Yeah, I hear you.
this is going to be a call for speculation on your part, but a breakaway civilization, the one that grew out of America anyway,
yes.
Do they have meetings? Is it centralized? They have weekly, monthly retreats and get together to plot things
oh,
out?
Boy.
How do you think what do you think? I mean, I know we're just guessing here, but what do you think? How's it work?
Well, that's an excellent question. And to be quite frank with you, in all of my thinking about all of this, that's something that never even occurred to me to ask. But my guess, George, on that would be, first of all, that there's going to be a control group, just as is suggested in the Majestic 12 documents. There's going to be some sort of executive council. And my bet is that these would be people that would know each other personally and trust each other as a matter of personal course. In other words, it's not going to be a group of Facebook friends, okay?
Right.
It's going to be a tightly knit network of corporate executives, military people, intelligence people that know each other personally and that have experience in the field. But I also suspect, and I think that there have been many UFO writers that have talked about this, that they are going to monitor the field of ufology and the field of alternative energy and even, for that matter, alternative research fairly closely. And I suspect that they have some sort of equivalent off-the-books, hidden sort of social networking or social medium that they can immediately exchange reports and ideas with each other. There has to be such a system if they're going to be competent at their job.
The president wouldn't necessarily have to know about this. I mean,
no.
It makes sense that it would be, most of it would exist outside of government, so you wouldn't have the public asking questions about it.
Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, which goes way back now a few years, but I point out in one of the Majestic 12 documents, and I don't even get into the argument of whether this particular document is authentic or not, because it's really the content of the document that I'm focused on. It points out that sometime in the early 1970s, I believe in the second Nixon administration, President Nixon himself privatized the whole Majestic 12 group. And in a certain sense, that makes a lot of reasonable sense, because if you're going to keep a secret like that, a secret that huge, really secret, the best way to do it is privatize it, corporatize it. And I think that there's every bit of evidence, given what Ben Rich has said and other people from that world have said, that this is exactly what happened. It's become a corporate phenomenon now.
Well, you look at the space program and what it's become. It's like a
yes.
job protection program. It's $17 billion just to sort of much do nothing. You draw up plans and then you cancel plans. I mean, we don't even have a way to get to the space station anymore. So I've sort of been encouraged by the idea that corporate private interests are getting involved in it and want to get us back into space, because our government sure as heck isn't doing it, not this government anyway.
Well, that raises the whole point. Why haven't they developed some of these programs that they've talked about, you know, going back to the moon and Mars? And I strongly suspect, George, that the reason that we're looking at is that they have a hidden capability, which they're trying. I believe at some point they're going to have to come public with it. And the real debate may just be, how are we going to do it? And that's what I think is in part maybe driving this current talk of asteroid mining and so on and so forth. Because they're going to have, let's be honest here, they're going to have some sophisticated alternative technologies other than chemical rockets to go out, snag an asteroid, haul it to the moon, and mine it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it'll be a Phil Corso kind of a scenario where they seed it out to private industry and pretend that somebody made the discovery.
Exactly. Exactly.
Joseph, you mentioned that you're working on another book. Can you give us a hint?
This book is kind of a sequel to another book that came out just in the last couple of years called Financial Vipers of Venice. It's a sequel to that book in the sense that it's kind of a hidden history conspiracy theory view of the Middle Ages and what I think may have been going on in the Middle Ages kind of behind the scenes.
I hope you'll keep us in mind when that comes out. I also just wonder when the day will come when we get to see some of this technology, but I hope you and I are around and have front row seats for it.
Me too.
Thanks very much. I hope people will check out that event in California, June 28th and 29th. And please come back and talk to us again, Joseph Farrell.
Sure, George. Thanks for having me back on.
All right. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. Brad Olson joins us in a moment. Modern Esoteric is the topic. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.